You're listening to a special edition of The Stack, first broadcast on the 26th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. It's been an interesting 12 months in the world of publishing. This past year, The Stack has looked at many different aspects of the industry, and we were delighted to see yet another year of enlightening and original titles hitting the newsstand shelves. We've considered the role of design in creating an eye-catching newspaper front page. We've investigated the intricacies of choosing the right paper stock, and we've even had an up-close and personal look at the role of today's erotic magazine. Today, we're closing the cover on the year that was. That's coming up on The Stack. On today's show, everyone loves a food magazine. But with the list of delicious titles becoming almost endless, how do you stand out?
I mean, we put so much care into every single photograph, into every single mood board and Pantone colour chosen. People obviously respond to that and they love it. They don't want to throw their magazine out. They want to keep it. They want to take it to bed with them and flick through it.
We'll hear the secrets of Australian foodie Donna Hay. Plus, we'll revisit this year's Bookworm Heaven in Frankfurt.
Many, many people are really doing their very best to keep their children close to written media and to keep the electronic media a certain step away from them to at least find a balance between those two.
Also ahead, they say the internet killed the porn mag. But some erotic titles continue to thrive. What's their secret? And we'll look back at our special episode dedicated entirely to paper. All that coming up on The Best of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to a very special edition of The Stack, looking back at some of our highlights from throughout 2015. I'm Ben Ryland and I'll be with you for the next hour as we leaf through some pages and determine what makes good print. First up, let's consider the concept of newspaper design. As an associate editor at the Telegraph World Edition, Terry Ramsey has acquired an eye for crafting the all-important front page. Well, earlier this year, he joined Monocle's Tyler Brulé and Simon Esterson, an influential art director with The Guardian, The New Statesman and the NZZ Am Sonntag under his belt, amongst many others.
I think the cover's still very important, if not more important these days, because in quite a lot of instances, people will know the front page news before they come to get the paper. So what you're selling with your front page design and your front page headline is a sort of brand, really, your take on the news. It's not going to be new information for a lot of your readers. So they want something that they can identify with and maybe reflects their own personality or their own vision of the news. I've got some pages here which came in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attack, because that was a classic story where everybody, more or less, you know, unless you're a hermit, knew that story by the time you came to pick up your paper the next day.
I mean, here you're showing, of course, the Telegraph did, very bold and headline, which I think we probably saw echoed in other parts of the English-speaking world as well, if not other languages, but fully sort of, you know, bold, all caps, war on freedom, and with that shot of the gunman, you know, out on the street below those offices.
Yeah. The War on Freedom headline is a label. It's not an actual news headline, is it? It's not saying to you people were shot yesterday in Paris, because it assumes that you already know that.
We look at sort of two of the tabloids, the Sun with just Non on the cover, 12 die in Paris mag shooting, and then the Daily Mirror with barbaric, same image, slightly different crop that they've used, with a terror bloodbath.
And both went with the image of the policeman who was about to be shot, and some newspapers, the Telegraph included, decided not to run with that image. I think maybe they thought it was just a little bit too brutal for them.
Now, I wasn't in the UK when this happened, and I'm just seeing the Independent cover for the first time, with a yellow hand, a bony finger, giving sort of the F off sign coming out of the pages of Charlie Hebdo. Is that exactly how it ran, or was this a special edition in under a traditional cover underneath?
No, I think this is
that was how it ran.
And,
yeah,
and I think it's fantastic that it decided to do that. You know, nobody else, one of the English papers attempted that, and I don't know. On a good day, you'd maybe wonder why The Guardian didn't ask Steve Bell to do something on the front cover. We haven't got a Guardian front page.
No, we don't. But it was quite traditional. It was a picture headline front page. As we move through these, you'll see that we move from the traditional British sort of front page, which has the picture and the headline, to much more artistic, much more continental ones, some of which have very little type at all, or they are pure design.
Just before we go, and we sort of cracked this show today, you just mentioned continental and the continental style of cover, and I to both of you, before we wrap up, do you think that, you know, whether it's graphic or whether it's an economy of words, you know, whatever it may be, does that start to have, you know, more value? And I'm actually wondering why we don't see more of it in the Anglo-Saxon world, because you don't see it on Aussie papers, you don't see it in the US or Canada, and you certainly don't see it so much here, aside from, of course, the independent cover that we're referencing. In a world where we are more visual and, of course, digital plays an increasingly large role, do you think that maybe if you're an art desk at a British or American paper, maybe that's a direction to look at?
I think it could be, because some of these continental front pages are very striking. The Politiken one, which is largely white with a broken pencil right in the middle of a huge white space, is very striking. But I don't think many of the mainstream British papers are bold enough to do that at the moment. I can't imagine, say, at the Telegraph or the Mail or the Sun, somebody saying, let's do a page like that. Not at the moment, because the tradition is big headlines, big pictures.
That's the great weakness. The English tabloid red top tradition is not a graphic design tradition. It's a kind of sub-editors carving it out live kind of tradition, and about news and urgency, and not about graphic design. And I think it's a very strange thing. We live in a world where everything's designed, but not the red top newspapers, not the Mail, not the Sun. Sorry, it's unfair to call the Mail a red top. Not the Mail, not the Sun, not the Mirror. And actually, I think it would be very interesting to see if you could reinvent those as a designed editorial object.
Terry Ramsey and Simon Esterson there, chatting to Monocle's Tyler Brulé in a highlight from back in January. Well, things got just a little bit racy here at Midori House when The Stack leafed through the pages of some of today's erotic magazines. Now, fittingly enough, we didn't settle for just any old publication that one might find at a gas station somewhere. No, founded by the Feminist Society at London's School of Oriental and African Studies, Hysteria magazine is a somewhat highbrow take on the erotic genre, discussing gender equality, sexuality, and capitalism through essays, poetry, comment, and photography, the latter largely of naked women in unusual environments or awkward positions. So what separates the objectification from the photography featured in Hysteria and similar publications? Well, asking that and other questions to Claire Urban, caught up with Hysteria's collaborator, Sarah Badawi.
First of all, I think it's important to emphasise that it is centred around three basic tenets, and in no particular order. The first being that capitalism is exploitative and should be resisted. The second, that patriarchy exists and needs to be eroded. And then kind of the last would be that gender and sexuality are multitudinal and can exist in many forms. The reason Hysteria as a magazine exists, I think, is to provide vocabulary to these discourses as well.
And can you tell us a bit about who contributes to it then?
So basically anyone can contribute, so everyone. But we have from well-known academics like Spivak to Nancy Fraser, and then also student activists, artists, poets, kind of anyone really. We're not prescriptive in that way.
Okay, do you have regular contributors?
We do, yeah. So we have a kind of core team that contribute every issue. So Amma Josephine Budge is in all the time, Bjork, obviously, Brinda. There is a core team that is always producing material, as well as commissioning as well.
Well, as we have discussed, this episode of The Stack is sort of all about sexuality and erotic publishing and this kind of thing in celebration of Valentine's Day.
Yeah,
can you talk a little bit maybe about how Hysteria covers sexuality?
For me, so like Catherine MacKinnon once very famously said, sexuality is to feminists what labour is to Marxists. So sexuality and gender are central issues. And so obviously any feminist publication should be constantly interrogating sexuality and erotica. And Valentine's Day obviously is is a feminist concern. The way Hysteria covers it is to disrupt it and to look at it critically. So, for example, in our forthcoming issue, we have a lot of discussion about the idea of consent, trying to understand what is consensual, you know, kind of challenging dominant thought about sex and sexuality, I think. And in fact, in our fourth edition, some of the ways that Hysteria tries to present female nudity is to show the female body in a state of contortion. So there's a photograph by Agata Cardoso. It's kind of unclear as to whether we're looking at a woman who's been decapitated or if she, her limbs have been removed, but she's sort of tied up as if with a string that they tie up pieces of meat. For me, that's quite representative of female nudity generally.
Would you say then that Hysteria attempts to present a flip side of nudity in publishing that is sort of in a non-pornographic way?
I think it attempts to. I think it's incredibly sort of impossible to do. We do try to kind of show the female body in a way that isn't immediately gratifying to the viewer.
Let's talk a little bit about your forthcoming issue. I know that that's coming out at the end of the month. So maybe tell us a little bit about the issue, what we can expect in it, and a bit about the front cover maybe.
So each issue is centered around a theme. So the new issue is nonsense. And the front cover is a painting called The Revolution Will Be Painted. And it's by an artist called Anne Sherwood Pundyke. And the image is kind of an orange-red background with these kind of multicolored squares in the corner that kind of fade out as you look down. And as a magazine that I think foregrounds art and artists as well, I think what we're doing is highlighting how important the written word is, but also how important art is in challenging dominant ways of thinking. As regards to the issue as a whole, the idea of nonsense is so we have a manifesto. When you open the fifth issue, we have a kind of nonsensical retelling of the manifesto, and part of the idea is how all of these paradigms that we were seeking to change or to acknowledge are by their very nature nonsensical, and it's really about challenging mainstream ways of presenting things, as in things you would not necessarily think about.
Monocle's Claire Urban there, talking to Sarah Badawi. Stepping into another genre of magazine now with Riposte. It's grown from strength to strength and is now seen very much as part of the canon of high-quality publishing for women. Danielle Pender is the founder and editor-in-chief of Riposte and a curator at KK Outlet, a gallery and communications agency here in London. She joined Monocle's Tyler Brulé and Steve Watson, the founder of innovative magazine distributor Stack, which he started 3 years ago in an attempt to help independent publishers find a wider readership.
I'm surprised when we put together an issue, I think, oh, we've got, you know, another 6 months to put together the issue and select people. And we always have a really long list of women that we want to speak to. But then I was just saying to Steve, sometimes it gets closer and closer and people drop out, and then all of a sudden you run a real short time frame to hit deadlines. And so there is sometimes still that tension. And because I still work, this is a sort of side project that I still spend a lot of time
on. Day job, not given up yet.
Yeah. Yeah, so it kind of, it's fits and starts. Sometimes it's nice to have that longer period of time, but then, sometimes it then gets really close to the nail.
You've both brought a great selection of magazines. I sort of feel the past few weeks, we've sort of gone off topic. So I want to let our listeners really sort of dive into some of the titles that you've brought in. Steve, I'll start with you. There's three here. I can also already see that you've duplicated as well, so we can have a big discussion on the titles that you both brought in. Where do you want to start? What do you want to look at first?
Well, should we start with the consensus? We'll start the mag we've both brought.
Yeah, well, okay. Why don't we do that? I'll start. Reveal what you've brought to the table today. Okay, and it's the one that we all love, because they're very nice to us as well.
So the new issue of Gym Class is out. I was talking to Steve about this the other night. He's sold out. So he only printed 200 of this one.
Right.
Deliberately kept things like very limited run. I stuck this up on the Stack Instagram yesterday morning, and there are literally people howling for reprint. You know, kind of, right. You've got to reprint this. We've got to have a copy. Which for me is exactly where you want to be if you're an independent publisher.
Absolutely.
You want to be selling out your run.
Now, I'm going to let either one of you define, for people who are not familiar with Gym Class and have not been able to get their hands on a copy, how would you define the magazine? And also, why did you bring it in today?
It is a magazine about magazines. So Steve is a big fanboy of independent and mainstream publishing. And I brought it in because on the front cover, he has a bold text-based cover and this statement reads, "Nobody cares about your oh-so-cool, kick-started, tactile, minimalist, unoriginal magazine. Plus, lots more must-read tough love for indie and mainstream magazine makers."
Mm. And so when we get into the pages, is this a bit of a manifesto for what he dives into, or...?
Well, I mean, the thing that everyone knows about Gym Class who loves Gym Class is that, you know, kind of tongue tends to be firmly in cheek. Mm. He has this fantastic, playful style. But that said, he is making a serious point about the, you know, the independent magazine market is changing so fast and we're seeing so many new magazines coming out. And actually, somebody does need to say, but hang on, where's the quality? It's not enough just to make something and say, I've made an independent magazine. Mm. You've still got to make something that's really great. And I think it's so important that it's Stephen who said this, because he is, you know, as Daniel was saying, he's a magazine fanboy. This is all coming from the purest and like most positive place, but it's really important it's being said.
I kind of agree and disagree with him. And obviously, like Tyler said before, he says really nice things about us, so I don't want to be mean about it.
But the point you'd like to make, yeah.
But I would like to make the point that I think if this is his sort of rallying cry, it would have been nice to have an article inside which was a bit more of a manifesto, which deals with some of the issues that I think he rightly, you know, there's a huge conversation about it, but he doesn't really delve into that, which I kind of would have liked to have seen.
Monocle's Tyler Brulé there in conversation with Danielle Pender and Steve Watson. Still to come here on The Stack, we'll dig into the pages of Australian foodie mag Donna Hay with the lady herself. That's next here on The Best of The Stack.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
Well, of course, this year also saw Monocle's first ever Quality of Life conference, which took place in the lovely city of Lisbon. We sampled some of that theme here on The Stack when we caught up with Donna Hay, the woman behind the Australian culinary magazine that bears her name. The doyenne of Australian food style and publishing called into our studios here at Midori House for a chat with Tom Edwards about how her print publications fit into her media empire and why her quality of life back at home means she could never leave Sydney.
I think when you're still passionate about what you do, 80 issues on, however many books on, that there's that real place for paper and print and the way it's crafted. Quite like Monocle, I think when you've got an exceptional print product, there's something different. We're not struggling. We're holding nicely in our market and our readers really appreciate what we do. I mean, we put so much care into every single photograph, into every single mood board and Pantone color chosen, everything that I, you know, people obviously respond to that and they love it. Then they don't want to throw their magazine out. They want to keep it. They want to tag it. They want to take it to bed with them and flick through it, apparently, is the feedback on our social media.
Everything's welcome, all these different proclivities. It's always encouraging to hear about when an investment in a great product pays off. And I think you mentioned already that you know readers are loyal, they're very committed to it, and they're willing to spend money supporting brands that they feel are representing the things that they're interested in, the values that they have. And that, in a way, speaks a little bit to this idea of sort of quality of life, which we're talking about a lot on Monocle 24 and in the magazine, because we've got our inaugural conference, which is looking at some of these quality of life issues. I just wondered, going right back maybe to issue one even, and through your other work, quality of life is a bit of a nebulous concept, but does that inform what you do, a notion of quality of life, whether it's how you work, how you live, how you put your projects together? Is it an important thing to consider? How are we describing quality of life?
When you look at a print product, it has to describe a quality of life. And for me, I'm a big personal advocate of that. Go back to issue one. That's really fun, like kind of strange story, is that I just came back from New York. I'd been offered a job by Martha Stewart. Arrived back in Sydney. It's summer. You can swim until 9 o'clock at night. Everyone's outside. It's a great place to live. And luckily enough, I was really unsure about moving to New York. I was unsure in myself that I could be that creative with that quality of life.
not being able to go for a swim after work and just do everything that Australia has to offer. So I was lucky enough that I was offered my own magazine. It felt such the right thing to do to stay. And that's why I haven't really been able to leave it as my base, Sydney, because for me, I can work as hard as you want me to. But if I don't have some sort of quality of life, I don't know that on the weekend I'm, you know, jumping on my stand-up paddleboard or I'm going to Bondi for a run with all the beautiful people. And, you know, if I don't have that kind of hook of quality of life, then I just can't sustain it. I can't sustain the workload and I really don't feel like I can sustain the creativity that I need.
In terms of that balance, I mean, there's that cliche about work-life balance, but, you know, you've obviously worked for big titles as a freelancer mm-hmm. in sort of independent sector, doing your own sort of burgeoning empire, if you like. Do you think it is easy to adhere to those principles, getting that balance right? Is it something that you try and do with your colleagues and with employees as well? Is it an easy thing to do, or do you need to work at ensuring that balance?
Oh, no, I think you need to be really, really disciplined. You can so get sucked into working crazy hours. And people look at me really strangely, but my office is open from 8:30 till 5:30. 6 o'clock is the absolute limit. When you're there, we have a whole heap of fun and we laugh, and I'm probably the most noise-making, joke-making, disruptive person in the office. But there's also a level of work that people do all day. They're not on their Facebook page. They work really hard when they're there and then they leave at 5:30. I don't want to see them there at 7:30. How creative are you going to be tomorrow if you've worked till 9 o'clock? It doesn't work for me and it shouldn't work. I don't feel like it works for the rest of my team. So when we're there, we have a lot of fun, but it's pretty intense. And then I want to see everyone out the door. If I see anyone there past where I am,
You're not happy.
Well, I'm not happy because I don't want them to be there. I want them to be outside enjoying themselves. And that's how they come back into the office and be creative, is that they've seen something or they've done something or they feel inspired or they feel rested, even happy.
That sounds like a very good idea to me. I'm making some mental notes. Making some mental notes for myself.
He's going to love me, isn't he?
little meeting with the editor in chief later. Donna, just tell us what else is coming up. What other things have we got to look forward to? Obviously, lots more great magazines. Where is your travels going to be taking you? What other things should we be looking out for? Any exciting news?
Oh, I'd like to do some more TV, but some sort of different TV. I think the biggest challenge with food and TV is that most of the people getting commissioned are men. There's not many women in the TV food arena. And there's a lot of interest in sort of like the cooking reality show sort of thing where I cook and then someone has to try and replicate it and I judge them. And I'm so not that person. I don't want to judge anyone. I'd like to think that you go home and maybe cook something this weekend and you know, invite your friends over or just eat something tasty.
But it's sort of friendlier almost. Collegiate approach to the sort of
absolutely. Yeah, that's a tough one to get around. Just wanting to do beautiful food that's styled well and in a beautiful location that people just want to look at that, I think. You know, there's a bit of voyeurism on TV when you see beautiful property shows or travel shows, and I think it should be in food as well. I don't always think it needs to be a game show.
Donna Hay there in conversation with Monocle's Tom Edwards. And our Quality of Life conference returns in 2016, taking place this time in Vienna. Check monocle.com for details. Now, as loyal Monocle 24 listeners would know, our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco is a man with his finger very much on the pulse of Brazil's media landscape. When he's not perusing the pages of the nation's daily newspapers in preparation for his regular spot on Monocle 24's daily programme, The 10, he can often be found indulging in one of his favourite homegrown titles, Trippy.
Nós somos jovens, jovens, jovens.
Well, my magazine of choice is Trip, which is actually a Brazilian magazine that talks about surf and girls. It's a very unusual choice because, to be honest, I don't surf and I don't like girls. But the interesting thing about Trip, that even though it's a surf magazine, they changed in recent years. They're becoming more political, so they have very, very interesting political reportage with some quite brave stories with themes that range from abortion to gay marriage. But there's always like photo shoots with guys surfing. There's this kind of relaxed attitude, which is in a way very Brazilian. And in fact, the first time when I got in touch with the magazine, scene. I remember I was a kid during my holidays because we had a house in the north coast in São Paulo on the beach. And when I went to the news agent, they just sold like Trip because, you know, there's a lot of surfers in that region and, you know, other gossip magazines. And then I bought it and it was quite interesting because there is some nudity, you know, there's like... It's some sort of playboy, but with more taste. And they chose only kind of surfer girls, you know, not with too many plastic surgeries. So it felt quite natural as well. The covers used to be quite generic, just a man with his surfboard or a kind of a pretty girl, sometimes, you know, showing everything, but always in the nature, you know, they liked that. It was never kind of artificial in a palace in Rome like Playboy would do. But they changed recently. And in fact, because I think the magazine is becoming more successful, they have two covers of the time. One, it's still kind of a surf image or a half-naked woman. And the other one is usually kind of not a celebrity, but someone who gave like a proper interview or a politician. Like, let's talk about abortion. Then they had a woman like saying, yes, I did abortion, which in Brazil is quite controversial. So there's two cover choices nowadays. And I have to say there's an interesting development for the magazine. They have a woman's version of the magazine as well, which was launched quite recently. And the name of the magazine is TPM, which is the name we gave, I think in English people say PMS, so... pre-menstrual syndrome. And it's quite an unusual name for a woman's magazine as well. And again, it's definitely not your average Vogue. I don't think I've seen a magazine similar to Trip anywhere in the world. And that's why perhaps a German editor, he was in Brazil and he was reading Trip and he was so fascinated, he decided to launch a German version of Trip, which is sold in Germany, Austria and Switzerland. That's quite a new thing because it's usually the opposite. Brazil have versions of foreign magazines like GQ, Vogue, Glamour, name it. You know, if you go to a Brazilian newsagent, there's so many versions, but now it's the opposite. We're actually exporting an idea. And I've read the German Trip. Of course, I don't understand German, but the layout's quite similar. They have some stories from the Brazilian version, but they also have their own stories. So that's quite an unusual thing about Trip, and that's why I like it so much.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco there, recounting the pleasures behind his favorite Brazilian magazine, Trippy. You're with The Stack on Monocle 24, looking back at our highlights over 2015. And to the casual reader, paper stock may seem like a mere detail barely worth consideration. Ask any publisher or passionate magazine aficionado, however, and they'll tell you, the kind of paper one chooses to print on can indeed be a game changer. John Haslam is Managing Director of Paper Specialists and Suppliers G.F. Smith. The company was founded in 1885 here in London and focuses on providing high-end paper choices to those who design and publish all manner of material from magazine inserts to perfume packaging. G.F. Smith also happened to supply the paper for our business cards and stationery here at Midori House. He was also joined by Ben Parker, director at Made Thought, a design studio that collaborates with G.F. Smith. They sat down for a chat with our own Tyler Brulé.
I think when you go to Japan and you see the cultural significance of paper in their within their culture, and you come to the UK, it isn't the same. And you go to Scandinavia and there's more of a respect for paper. And it's been a little bit of a lowest common denominator here for a number of years. So G.F. Smith have always had a good profile with what they do and an ambition. But to actually start to raise the bar a little bit more has been a joy. And and ultimately, we all not only rebrand them, but we've used the paper day in, day out for the last 15 years.
Now, aside from just a branding assignment, how far does this project extend beyond this wonderful block that I have in front of me here? So, of course, this has been something which has gone through the entire business. But does it also manifest itself as even sort of the built environment as well?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, our challenge is to raise the perception of how people use paper. So one of the activities that we're trying to do is actually bring paper back to a physical manifestation. And if we talk about brands like Takeo in Japan, they really elevate paper to that level. And it's just not a print commodity, a sort of lowest common denominator print commodity. So we've actively, with J.S. Smith, tried to create installation pieces that show paper in a new way and a new way of using this incredible material.
John, tell me right now, have you seen a different type of approach when when agencies approach you, when you're looking for sort of new types of partnerships. Clearly, you're not dealing sort of in everyday stock anyway. Mm-hmm. And you reference that sort of bit of people being good at sort of the premium, sort of the luxury end of the market. Does that actually create more scope for you now? So when people really want to go and do an assignment, they're really going sort of much deeper and broader than they might have done in the past?
Yeah, I think we're trying to create and inspire and educate the students. And we're spending a lot of time with education around the world. And we're making sure that every student, when they come out of a graphic design course or an illustration course or an advertising course, they understand the power of the paper. And there's this whole need and actually want, you know, you need that paper on your desk, that photocopy paper that you've printed out your notes. You need that. But actually you want a beautiful paper for your business card because that's your message to the market. You know, you might ask, when we put the collection together, why did we actually put a beautiful letter in that's actually die-stamped? You know, we could have just printed that. We've die-stamped that. That's an extra 30% of cost. But when people get that letter, the world will see that beautiful letterhead, you know, and they'll touch that or feel that. And we always say one eye sees, one eye feels. And you're judging the quality of paper or any product before you even see it, you're touching it. You know, certainly all the branding we've done, all the work we've done with the collection, we're elevating the role of paper. So a designer, when they present that to a client, they see if I use that paper, first of all, it will look beautiful. That's a given. But will it act to increase the revenue for that client? And when we want to educate the designer, so not just to produce beautiful portfolio work, but actually to deliver profit for their end user and actually deliver, you know, quantifiable profit that if you do this, you'll get 25% more direct mail response on that piece of literature.
I want to come back to the point about education in a second, but Ben, this is the time of year running an agency that, of course, you've got a lot of people probably coming in, showing their portfolios, showing their work. I've noticed from our side, you know, within Midori House that we've moved, maybe it's only been in the last 2 years, last 18 months, but I probably felt like, but 2 years ago, I would have a lot of screen presentations, even for print work before. It was, you know, it's just lighter. I guess you whack your laptop or your tablet, whatever it may be, in your backpack, and you know, you go around and you go and show your work. I've sort of noticed that people are definitely, you know, using a bit of muscle power, and they're bringing all of their printed work again. And I'm wondering if you've noticed the same type of change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was one of my points that I was thinking about today is that, you know, a lot of the designers we see now, it is literally a bag full of beautiful things that they bring out.
Yes.
And it shows the difference between a screen experience. So there's been an obsession with showing things as PDF files on screen. But within our industry and the high consideration brands that we work with, maybe a different term to luxury, that is the tangible difference where these brands can make a difference. So when the designers come in, we don't want to see it on screen. You can't feel it and experience it. So yes, absolutely. It's a big shift. And I think the last two or three people I've seen have literally come in and put a pile of interesting things, as we've done with you today, on the table.
Just before we go to break, John, tell me, how are you working with educators around the world? I guess, you know, in the case of many companies, they're just offering up lots of paper. Is it it is a broader process than that when you're working with various institutions?
Yeah, we have really good relationships with the director of graphics, and these are global universities, and we're actually producing a pad of every paper, color paper we do in the Color Plan range. Every student in the world will get access to this. For a no-profit exercise, you know, so we've got to pay for them to produce, and they might cost them £5 each or whatever, but they'll have access to a complete glossary of paper. And we'll also produce a presentation for the world, so every course lecturer on graphics around the world can press a button, and part of the curriculum, the use of paper and the power of paper and print will become part of that curriculum.
I think also, I mean, the responsibility, I think, of a brand like GF Smith is not only education, and it's been doing that for a long time, even through the 60s and the litho sort of revolution, but also it's about inspiration. And I think that's the key ingredient that a lot of paper companies just haven't always tagged on to.
Right.
It's a bit of an afterthought, but it's to inspire and to educate. And that becomes a very powerful way to communicate to your audience.
Tyler Brulé there with Ben Parker and John Haslam. Now, for any magazine creative, the importance of words cannot be understated. But magazine publishing is a visual medium, and the power of the written word is somewhat diminished without the creative visual design that goes with it. Patrick Burgoyne is one of the UK's most respected design commentators. He's been the editor of Creative Review magazine since 1999. Before that, he worked in marketing, first for The Body Shop and later for the University of Westminster. He's also the author of several books on design and visual culture. Here he shares some of his thoughts on the role of visual design in magazine publishing with Monocle's Tom Edwards.
I'm indebted here again to our art director, Paul, because he was at an evening event for the Editorial Designers Organization recently, where they have a kind of designers car boot sale, come bring and buy thing, where people bring along treasured old copies of magazines and, you know, copies of Twen go for hundreds of pounds each. But he spotted these issues of Good Housekeeping and couldn't really believe the quality of the design of some of them. You know, it's not necessarily the sort of title you would have thought of as being a design leader, particularly in this period. You would think of, you know, Nova and Twen and those sorts of magazines. But just looking at this issue from 1964 in particular, the art director was this guy called Jack Larkin, who there's been a kind of a little bit of revival of interest in recently. Mike Dempsey, who writes a really good blog on design, picked him out as a bit of a forgotten hero a while ago. He used to do a lot of book cover design, for example. But just going through it, I mean, some of the use of different paper stocks in here, overprinting, two-colour printing. I mean, you've got some proper hardcore modernism in here. And I'm just looking here at an issue about the Catholic Church, where there's a black and red overprinted headline that just repeats the word Catholics over and over. I mean, it's really graphic, strong stuff, and not at all what the kind of cliched view you might have of something like Good Housekeeping.
Well, it's interesting that it's still, and then you'll have a page with a nice picture of a, you know, a cake on a cake.
Yeah,
stand.
So that stuff's still in there alongside
the next
this.
Turn, yeah,
alongside this really amazing design that could have come, you know, could have come from any of the greats, I suppose. And you've got a real investment in terms of the structure of the magazine and using different formats. So there's a piece here about going on a cruise, which might not sound that exciting, but then they've treated it in this way with a throw-out section. Again, it's all red and black, fantastic illustrations of a few kind of outfits you might have for when you're on your cruise, whether you're dancing or play clothes. I'm not quite sure what that would be. And what to remember in terms of, you know, taking your shore excursions and your luggage and changing money, but all done in this really beautiful, really quite daring style. And then there's this, again, another section on coloured paper in the centre, which is the Good Housekeeping Institute, which is still alive and well today, I think, where they test out all these different products. But this looks like it could be some sort of, you know, annual report for some serious...
I was going to say, some, you know, just sort of German industrialist,
yeah,
or something.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, it's incredible. And it's again, it's sort of two colour, really, really beautifully set out, really nice use of illustration. It was just a great surprise and a reminder that, you know, it wasn't just those few hallowed titles back then who were doing great editorial design.
And it's funny because we started off by talking about, a sort of almost a return of that aesthetic sensibility, the value of great design. And yet it's hard to imagine Good Housekeeping of today investing in that sort of design approach. So I don't know, or is this where we at risk of looking back through rose-tinted spectacles?
I suppose it is a bit. I mean, you know, funnily enough, we've got three issues here, all from a similar period, and the design has changed dramatically. So they were obviously searching around at that time for the right formula. They weren't quite sure what they were doing, and that, I guess, gave them license to experiment. And, you know, I'm sure today it's probably very commercially successful and they know their readers inside out and they give them what they want. But I think more it was just this real surprise that a title like this, as mainstream as this, could be as daring as this in an era where people, you know, didn't have so much visual culture in front of them all the time, every day. And I would imagine, you know, if you were a subscriber anywhere in the UK and you would get this magazine, you know, there would be a lot here that's really quite challenging alongside the more mainstream stuff. And I think that's really interesting.
I think that's one of the things that always strikes me about magazines. You go back to, it's a 1966, I think you've got there, that edition. It looks like something from swinging London with its bright yellow and all of this. That's where people got their inspiration from. Exactly as you just said, there wasn't this preponderance of media, so people weren't exposed to these things. You'd wait till this arrived at your doorstep where you picked it up in the shop, and it would be like opening a world of newness that don't really get elsewhere. And today, it's really hard for magazines to do that, I guess, in the same
way. It is hard. I mean, going back to the Brazilian title, you know, it's hard, even with a subject matter like that, to do something which... You are utterly surprised by and just does feel completely new. And I think, you know, with these issues of Good Housekeeping, you know, if you were anywhere in the UK in a sort of small town and this arrived through the mail, and you've got this real kind of challenging Swiss modernist approach to some of these features, you know, you'd be thinking, wow, this is the future.
Well, let's bring it back up to speed then. We've got a couple more titles that you've brought. I've got a couple here as well. I've got I, of course, Review of Graphic Design in your sort of ballpark. I mean, yep. do you, how does it work for you? Do you sort of peruse the newsstand regularly and see, is it about looking at what your, inverted commas, rivals are doing? Or do you just have, is it fairly sort of broad church? Are you interested to just keep abreast of,
well, we always,
of what different titles are up to?
We definitely always keep an eye on what other people are doing. And partly that's for inspiration. And partly it's you know, just because you need to do that. But I think we're quite a friendly bunch, I think, in the visual communications graphic design world. And certainly we know the guys at I and think they do a fantastic job. The magazine always looks amazing. I think it does obviously a slightly different thing to Creative Review, and more so now with the way that we've sort of changed our approach slightly. But you know, I think the attention to detail and the quality of the photography and the print and the production is always very, very, very high. So you know, it's certainly something that we admire, and I think it's great to have a title like this going into design studios, inspiring designers and students.
Monocle's Tom Edwards there, chatting to Creative Review magazine's Patrick Burgoyne. Earlier this year, a special edition of The Stack took things out of the studio and into the event space here at Midori House. In a special hour-long live panel discussion, Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, was joined by guests Gert Jonkers of Fantastic Man, editor of Paris Match, Olivier Royant, media strategist Ian Birch, and world-renowned graphic designer Eric Speakerman to discuss the current state of the print industry. In this extract, the largely disliked term native advertising came up in conversation when Tyler asked Fantastic Man's Gert Jonkers about his advertising model.
We hardly do editorials in the magazine, so we know they're out there a lot, but we usually think that it's quite a clear relationship to just have advertisers advertise, and then we do whatever we do. I would almost say, you know, and we have really good people working for us on the commercial side, but overall, we're not very good commercially in the sense that it maybe
well,
sounds...
you're still here after a decade, so you're doing something right,
exactly.
For sure.
No, it's working, but we're all... And I think that's part of being an independent, you know, whatever that means, because, you know, what is independence? But I think we're independent just because we own our own company, etc. But the reason for an independent, I think the sort of like thing that signifies an independent is that we're informed by the content and not so much by the business model. I mean, we never made a business plan. The first time we went to a bank, they
just... Is there a business plan now?
No. Please. No, we're really informed by... We do what we want to do. And so I would almost say, you know, we have very clear ideas of what Fantastic Man is, but there's not really a format. You know, people sometimes have, what's the format of the magazine? We don't really know, because we do what we want to do. And then next issue, we're going to do what we want to do for the next issue. Mm. And those collaborations that we've done, the first thing we did was a jean with Acne, and we did a fragrance, and we just did a t-shirt with Carhartt. But they're quite small
underpants.
Things. Underpants. We did underpants. But that was almost a need to make
new pants.
Exactly, yeah. To make good underpants and t-shirts. And not a business idea. So those collaborations, you know, we like doing them, but they're... I would sometimes say they even cost us money, because we want to do them well.
Sure.
You know, and then, you know, whenever you read people, sort of like when they're working with big retailers and they say like, oh, I want three buttons on this jacket, but we could only afford two. Mm. You think like, oh my God, I mean, if that's sort of, if you have to design things that way, how is something good going to come out of it?
Yeah.
So, does that answer your question?
Well, sort of, but then I don't think that something like The Gentlewoman just sort of happens without someone working with, maybe not, but not working in Excel, they can have an abacus and a piece of paper.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, there's a lot of logistics that go into doing things to make a lot of people happy, yeah. And most of all, the reader.
Sure, so. And absolutely. But do you think that, you know, and maybe, and this is, you know, we can sort of, I think, widen out this discussion, but I guess part of what you're saying as well is you're not driven by a margin. You know, if you make sort of, someone says, yes, we make 3% at the end of the year, hooray, you know, Hope Holland, this is all great, then it's fine, as opposed to someone that we have to make 15%, and therefore you end up in one button territory.
Yeah, yeah, no. I mean, I wouldn't even know what our margin is. Interesting.
Yeah, no, and it's sort of, you know...
And all business plan pure poetry? I mean, I can write a business plan for anybody here in 10 minutes. You either have your expenses already, so you add a bit on the sales side to make the expenses, or vice versa. You have your imagine I'm going to sell 100,000 magazines and therefore I can afford so many people. It's all total rubbish. The banks want it, but... I've written business plans, but they're just total imagination. How do I know whether I'm going to sell anything at all, or whether I need more than two people? If you're successful, you need two more people. Business plans are total rubbish. There's a whole industry that lives by them, and I have never, I can invent one, like I said, for everybody in this room. They are total rubbish. You don't know. You go out there and you do it.
Exactly.
And then you adjust, and then you hire more people if you can afford to.
Do we think the Hearst building and many other towers in Europe need more Eric Speakermans to in their lobby to sort of, you know, make their way up the lift?
If only they did.
Well, we could get rid of a whole business, you know, people who write those business plans. They'd all be consultants, banks would all be out of business tomorrow.
Isn't that part of it though? I've always sort of talked about this crisis caused by consultants as well. I mean, just the money deployed on people sort of thinking that they know better because they've somehow convinced me that they've got a crystal ball and that they know where the industry is going. And Ian, for you, and then Olivia, I'd love your point of view on that, because I'm sure it's certainly... you've been in many meetings like that, I'm sure.
Yeah, many, many meetings. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to hear you talk, because where I've been working, it is so much the opposite end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. You know, it is... That kind of thinking would be inconceivable. Mm. And when you were talking about native advertising at one company I was at, I think they spent more time and money on presentations on what actually native advertising was.
Than actually getting the pages, the damn thing, yeah.
And I must have seen in excess of 4 or 5 presentations around what is native advertising, you know. Mm. And the whole point about native advertising is it's something that, like, fashion magazines in particular have been doing for decades and doing it brilliantly.
Mr. Ronson's Playboy, yeah.
End of story.
I thought it was done for the natives, always. That's what
it almost sounds like.
Depends how you define natives.
I'm just finding out something new today.
Yeah.
I thought native advertising was done for people like me who are native to wherever they buy the magazine. Is that not the case?
No.
Oh, okay.
But it might be true that.
And you mean embedded, as in...
Yeah, I think embedded.
As in journalism.
Actually, that's it. Yeah. You've heard it here first, embedded advertising. Yeah.
That was a highlight from a very special live edition of The Stack, broadcast from right here at Midori House. Well, naturally, we here at The Stack are rather fond of the humble book fair, and for many, nowhere does it better than Frankfurt. In a special edition of The Stack recorded at the fair, Tyler Brulé spoke to Thomas Lindner, CEO of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung paper. Like much of the industry, this giant of the German publishing world has faced challenges of its own. But by testing the waters with new concepts and enhancing its brand, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung is throwing shade on cynical predictions and marching instead to its own beat.
Thomas, we're sitting at the heart of what has become the world's most important book fair. Is this a German story today? Because when we look at publishers in North America, the English-speaking world, we see a lot of retreat from print still, lack of investment in just pure printing presses at the moment, still a lot of skepticism if the money is still on paper. You're, of course, running one of the most respected newspapers in Europe. Do you still see it as a viable sector when we actually talk about print editions?
My impression is that the printing business in Germany is still a very viable business. After all, of course, we are experiencing a slow retreat of advertising money. We are experiencing a small decline of circulation of magazine sales. But on the other hand, it's still a huge market. If you look at the sales numbers, how many magazines are sold each day in Germany, or how many books are sold each day all over the country, it remains a huge market, and the decline is there, yes, but it's comparably slow.
Do you think Germans have a moral responsibility almost to correct the rest of the world, to correct this message? Because, of course, this is the world's fourth biggest economy, so maybe you need to be the ones to remind everybody of this message, because right now it seems that the paper industry, the book industry, it's slightly getting drowned out by a Wall Street narrative.
I think it's kind of my job to say yes to this, to answer that question with a clear yes. I don't think it is our job or there's even a chance to tell other people what to do. I just know that in our culture, there's a strong tendency to keep up the idea of books, magazines, and reading in general. Many, many people are really doing their very best to keep their children close to written media and to keep the electronic media a certain step away from them to at least find a balance between those two. And I cannot really see that there's a strong tendency of giving up the print business in favor of some kind of electronic business or products or whatever.
Do you think we're coming full circle right now? A major newspaper publisher like you, you've, of course, done many things digitally. Then again, you know, you're in any major train station or airport around the world, of course, you still see your print edition as well. Is it time to come back to a bit of print experimentation? Have we come full circle slightly?
I think we have to try new things out, and I think we have to convince our audience, not only by our readers, not only by the pure content, but also by the way we present it. And therefore, it's also about surprise, it's also about entertainment, and I think the German industry is doing a real good job. We see magazine launches each month. We see a very viable, a very energetic book business, a lot of authors. If you win a book prize here, you're really important in society. So things are important and remain important, and I think that is one of the main triggers that the industry is doing, I guess, comparably well.
Are we seeing a greater coming together of various print organizations? This started as a book fair, but it seems that they want to talk retail now. They want to talk much more about innovation. I feel we're seeing more magazines and newspapers also coming in to this forum than ever before. There's a major, of course, magazine conference on in Toronto at the moment, but there seems to be a lot of emphasis on periodicals, also newspapers. Is this something the industry needs to do? And I'm not just talking about, you know, getting bulk discounts on, of course, you know, buying pulp. But is there maybe a little bit more harmonization between these companies, do you think?
I think what you can observe is two things. First, you see a consolidation in the industry. Companies are buying each other and getting bigger. The other tendency is towards innovation and differentiation, meaning that you try to find out what your brand can actually do for your readers or for your customers, and then you expand into product fields where you think your brand can be successful. So you have both things. You're shrinking at the one side, on the other side you're expanding, and you are expanding actually into new fields. And what you see here at the book fair in Frankfurt is exactly that book publishers are thinking about magazines, that magazine publishers are creating books. So yes, things are growing a little bit more together.
Thomas Lindner there, speaking to Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, during a special edition of The Stack from the Frankfurt Book Fair. And finally on today's show, we usually spend some time leafing through some of the preferred titles of our studio guests. So keeping that tradition, let's hear a snippet from earlier this year. Some months ago saw what was certainly 2015's biggest shake-up of the media landscape when the Nikkei purchased the prestigious UK-based newspaper The Financial Times. Soon after that announcement, Tyler Brulé joined Tom Edwards from Monocle's Tokyo Bureau with his take on the state of the nation's newsstand.
A lot of the conversation, of course, you can't get away from the Nikkei discussion and the FT. It is it's amazing how it punctuates so many conversations. And of course, people know that the Nikkei are an investor in Monocle. So, you know, that might kick off some conversations. But I have to say, I've met so many people in Tokyo over the past 4 or 5 days, though, who probably are quite distant from things, who probably don't even know about a relationship. And, it's like, you know, toss away. What, you know, what do you make of this deal, you know, that Japan, you know, bought one of the most respected newspapers in the world. So that has really been really sort of front of mind. And I think there's a sense of pride here, Tom, that people are really excited that this is a real symbolic moment, that, you know, maybe it's not the biggest deal out of corporate Japan, but certainly when you think about the acquisition of a big brand, this has people quite excited, actually.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, Tyler, because we've just started to see in some of the British press here, really for the first time actually since the deal was announced, some questions being asked about what exactly the Nikkei ownership will look like. Could it shape editorial, shift editorial direction? You've got quite an interesting vantage point on this because you understand that medium very well, but you've also got a better understanding than most of sort of Japanese corporate culture. Do you have any, what do your sort of instincts tell you, Tyler, about how that relationship could grow over time?
Oh, Tom, if people would have been sitting around on table 27 or table 34 at Shiseido Parlor when I was having lunch with all of my Nikkei friends on Wednesday, they would certainly be sort of saying a lot. Of course, we are very close to this. We've been having some interesting conversations. I think that the main message I think that is coming through, though, the Nikkei is very proud of this purchase. This is a brand that is, meaning the FT, is doing a lot of things right. I think what's more interesting what this deal has done is it's actually prompted a lot of soul searching, I think, on the part of the Nikkei. But also, I think your question about sort of the Japanese media establishment, you know, how could it be that, you know, this was the world's second biggest economy, it's now the world's third biggest economy. You know, how could it be that, of course, you know, their biggest news brand in many ways is so unknown? So I think there's this sense right now, does the Nikkei and maybe some of their competitors, do they have to really start sort of crafting a message and a story where people elsewhere in the world, you know the power and the scale and the size of these businesses? And I think that's actually the bigger question, as opposed to what are they going to do with the Financial Times? And what I seem to hear is that they are going to leave it alone. I think there is, you know, they're even sort of saying, oh God, you know, are people, is going to become the Nikkei FT and things like that? No, that's absolutely not why they were looking at the brand. They know the power of it. But is it powered by the Nikkei? And are there many things that the Nikkei, of course, can bring to the broader deal? Absolutely. And I think that's, of course, a very exciting thing when they look at sort of the correspondent network, et cetera. So I think from a news gathering point of view, there's certainly a lot that is brought to the party. But I don't think people have a lot to worry about. I always come back to that notion, you know, here's a newspaper that not just in London, you know, where they're covering just the Japanese football industry with correspondents all over the world, which is kind of amazing.
Tom Edwards and Tyler Brulé there discussing the Japanese press earlier this year. And that's it for this very special edition of The Stack, looking back at some of the highlights in 2015. The show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and edited by Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, drop us a note over at info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back with a brand new show next Saturday. And of course, you can always catch up over at monocle.com or iTunes. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Ben Ryland. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.